If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week was one-fifth of the Saturdays, but prior to joining the band, she honed her craft, spending her evenings and weekends gigging around her native island, carrying her own PA system and guitar, playing in any bar or venue that would have her. Born to a GP father and a mother that loved to sing, her uncle was a big country music star back home in Ireland, so music was always a part of family life. And while she gigged by night, she hedged her bets and studied nursing and teaching by day before taking the leap to make music her full-time focus when she jumped the ferry to London at 23 to start a new chapter in her professional music life. Very quickly, she successfully auditioned for the Saturdays, and the group propelled her to international stardom. As the band clocked up hit after hit, she met, fell in love, and then married rugby star Ben Foden, and they went on to have two children together, a son and a daughter. Life looked rosy, and despite the band calling time and taking a break to pursue solo careers, she was happy raising her children in England whilst establishing herself as a country artist, heading out to Nashville to work with some of country music's biggest names. Then life as she knew it changed. Just as she was about to relocate to New York for her husband's work, their marriage came to an end as a result of his infidelity. And whilst he moved to the States, she and their children stayed in London, eventually moving back to Ireland last year after the first lockdown. He quickly fell into a new marriage just 2 weeks after meeting his now wife, and they have a daughter of their own. It was, to state the obvious, a lot to deal with. A difficult time, but she did deal with it, and she's been back in the studio working on her latest release, Swear It All Again, as well as hosting her own breakfast show every Saturday morning on Country Hits Radio. So let's dial up Una Healy. Una, how the devil are you in this, the longest year we've ever lived through?
I know already. It's a continuation of 2020. That's what it is. Oh, it's God, like an extended 2020. Yeah, everyone was like dying for 21 and we're still here.
But also you're locked down with two very little kids. And I think that means that you're having a very different lockdown, for example, to me, because that's tough.
It was very tough the first time around. So the first lockdown, I was in the UK, just myself and the two kids. And I had no support, no family around me. I couldn't really leave the house, so much so that just outside my door, there was like a pigeon's nest, and the pigeons, I saw them fly the nest, the two, when they were teenagers. So they actually built a nest, hatched and flew the nest all in the time, because I never left my house because I couldn't leave the kid. I wasn't allowed to bring the kids to the supermarket, so I was getting all deliveries, and I was literally like a massive hermit in the house with the two kids. And I found it really hard. And I said, I'll never, never, ever go through that again. So that's why I've moved back to Ireland, actually. And I'm here now. I've got my parents that live next door, basically. So I've got lots of support and just other people. You know, I found it really lonely and sad and horrible. Like, yeah, it was really tough. But sure, I wasn't the only one. You know, there was I've got quite a few friends in a similar situation to myself who were also single parents as well. And they were going through too. So we had like a group chat, and we used to just make kind of fun out of the whole thing, really, and have our little Zoom nights and stuff. So, yeah.
Now that you're settled back in Ireland, I mean, that was a big thing to do, to move as a single parent with two little ones and not start a new life because you're stepping back into familiar ground. But how's that been for you, relocating and repositioning your family unit?
Quite exciting, actually. I remember, like, my mum came over and helped me move house and stuff, you know. So we filled up a truck. I actually gave quite a lot of my furniture away to charity because I didn't want to have to just bring a massive truck over. And because I was moving home, I knew the furniture was here. So I just brought the essentials back with me. And so a little van actually just went ahead and went on the ferry. And then I drove my car and had the kids and my mum. And I found it was quite like exciting heading across the sea, because when I moved to the UK 12 years ago for the Saturdays, I came over on the ferry with my car, and it's kind of like done a full circle going back again. But like so many people are moving home and moving out of the city or just going back to their roots, and it sort of feels, well, it's quite a little adventure, really. But I'm happy to be home. Like I'm very, very settled in here now. And I'd always come to visit, and I've still quite a few friends around. So it's actually really nice. I love it. Well, I do think it's important to kind of cleanse and to make a new start.
And, you know, pouring your feelings out into important places is something you do as a songwriter, especially as somebody that writes country music, because there's no getting around it. Country is all about heart and soul, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very much like storytelling. And as a singer-songwriter, there, you know, most country artists are singer-songwriters, where they'll sing their own songs about their lives, very personal, actually. And they're not scared to pour their hearts out. And I've been like that since I was 12, when I started to write songs, because I started writing in my teens, and I was always just very honest and open about how I felt. And you can always sort of tell what song is about what, you know, if you listen back. But I never like to go too personal, because then other people won't be able to take that song and make it their own. I always think it's very important to write something that everybody, because once that song is out, it's for everyone, and you just want people to think, God, that's my story, or that's my life. Because there are only really two songs ever written. They're always about love. One is about falling in love, being in love, or else falling out of love and being, you know, sad about it. So you kind of have to just rewrite it in as many ways as possible.
The country music, I'm intrigued by your past. You are from such a musical family. Country music must have seemed like an odd way for you to go, for people that only knew you through the Saturdays. But actually, it sits in your family. You're from a family of singers and country artists. So this goes way back for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a musical family. My uncle is a country and Irish singer, very well known, Declan Nerney. And then his sister is my mom. And she actually taught me the guitar when I was 12 and taught me the first few chords. And just growing up with that on the radio, like my mum would always have the stations on waiting for my uncle to come on. So I was listening to that. I was raised on country music, and I guess being a guitar player and playing that sort of, you know, heartfelt stuff, writing songs, it just really slots into the country genre, which is like huge at the minute. There's so many crossovers happening as well. So there's no way really of avoiding country right now. It's just become so universal, really. But my kind of background is like from the country and Irish. That's what I grew up on. And I just loved people like Sheryl Crow would be my idol. I remember like first listening to her when I was 12, and loved all the singer-songwriters. I loved Garth Brooks, Shania Twain, all that 90s kind of country. Loved it. Faith Hill, yeah. When I was in the Saturdays, it was a departure from my country roots. But I'm back doing it again now. And it's sort of country rock pop, I would say. The genre of singer-songwriter, and kind of straddles a few of the genres, really.
But, you know, the country artists, it's funny because it's about the direction of travel, I suppose. Like a lot of artists, like Miley Cyrus, for example, started out and is considered to have, you know, great staunch country roots, but can quite easily travel and do pop. Do you find that this is accepting when you're going in reverse and you're coming from a huge pop outfit like the Saturdays to try and record country? Were the country community open to you?
I think it's like, yeah, it's probably the other way around to, like, say, Taylor Swift, who started country and then she went pop, and now she's sort of going back to country again, which is lovely. Folk, you know, I love folk music. I love all the kind of Celtic folk as well. But I think a lot of people, I was very open about the fact that I was following the singer-songwriter path before the Saturday. So anyone that would have followed us would have known my background, and any opportunity to whip out the guitar for like acoustic performances and that kind of thing, I would always be there with my guitar ready to go. So I think it wasn't a huge surprise to our fans at the time, but maybe to the general public who wouldn't have known me from before would be like, what's she doing in country for now? Who does she think she is, you know? But yeah, I guess it was a bit of a surprise to some, but I'm just doing what I love, you know. I do it because I love it and it's my passion. Obviously, the music industry is in a very strange place at the minute, without any gigs, nowhere to perform. Everything is on, like most things, is on Zoom. And it's tough, but the great thing is that we can still release music, which is nice because people need to to be entertained. And it's very important that we still keep recording music and creating music and all that as well.
I love the fact that your mother has a safe full of envelopes and each one arrives sent by registered post and they're all addressed to you in the same handwriting. None of them apparently have ever been opened and they all contain tape recordings of the songs that you've been writing since you, as you've said, first picked up a guitar at the age of 12. And you said you used to send them to yourself to establish your copyright, just in case someone like you too discovered one and had a hit with it. Is this right?
Yeah. So like back in the day, this was actually legitimate. This is what you had to do. So the form of copyright. So like this was probably pre-internet, all that. Like you couldn't just email the song to yourself just like that. You had to actually record the song. So at the time it was a tape recorder. Record myself singing the demo of this amazing song that could be a massive hit for someone one day, or myself or whoever. And I was like, just in case it gets into the wrong hands or somebody overhears me singing it and claims it's theirs, I got to copyright it. So put it in, you write the lyrics out, you write the date. Yeah, I even did the little C, you know, with the circle around it.
Yeah. How old were you, by the way, when you started doing this?
I was like, you know, maybe 14, 15. I would go down to the post office and they'd look at me because everyone in this town knows each other. And I'd be like, can I send this to set register post? And they'd look at me and go, this is to this town. And then they'd look at me and go, is it to yourself? And I'm like, I said, look, it's a long story. Just make register post. I'll sign for it. Just send it to me. And they're like, OK, that'll be £5. And like back in the day, that was a lot of money, you know, to part with for like the safety of this song. But it could be worth millions at the end of the day if you two were to get to catch the, you know, wind of it. And then Mammy had a safe where she used to put the safe, like, you know, in case someone came during the middle of the night and wanted to rob them off their and they're still in there. Yeah. So I've got like about 30 of them, I think, all sent to myself. But that was the requirement. So to join the, which is called the Irish Music Rights Organisation, IMRO, one of the requirements is that, yeah, you've got to. So every time, like it's the same then, if the song goes on and has a hit, then it's registered. So that song then is down as being a legit song that you wrote. And then if it ever comes up in court, you know, you can be like, look, wasn't opened, wasn't tampered with. Look at the date.
You knew how to do this at the age of 14. You were quite an extraordinary young starter on so many levels. Like everything you did really well. Like when you didn't just swim, you swam for the country or for the county, didn't you?
Yeah, I grew up in the pool, really.
And then you gave that up to write music?
At like 4 years old, I actually nearly drowned in the pool. I ran in after we used to go swimming with my mother, and I had my armbands on, and my sister was still in swimming, and we were just having a shower, and she was like, oh, go, was your sister not out yet? And I said, I'll get her. And I ran in and I jumped in without my armbands, and I'd never swam without them before. So the lifeguard actually had to pull me out. And I remember that sensation of drowning, of like not being able to keep myself up. And I was only four, but it never put me off. I actually think I went back and I said, I'm going to swim. There was a little girl actually in town jumping in the deep end at the time. And I was like, I need to be like her. So I went down and I learned how to swim the following week, actually. And then the swimming club were looking for new members, and it was meant to be just for 8 year olds plus. But I think I was only four or five and I joined, and I just took off. It just really suited me. I loved it. I was a really good swimmer. So I went on to represent the county a few times in the All-Irelands. And then I won an All-Ireland gold when I was nine. So that was like always one of my goals. And then once I achieved that and kind of carried on swimming, I sort of felt that it was tough to keep up with other counties and towns in Ireland because they were all swimming twice a day, and I was in this little town that had no swim club at the time, so I was like training myself. So it,
how do you do it when you've got no access to the club and the trainers and the team? You know, that's hard, isn't it? And you still managed to go on and win.
I used to have to swim during public hours, and like, you know how people do wits, and it used to be so annoying because I was trying to like go for it doing lengths, and then they'd always be like going, I'd see them in the distance like doing their like little breaststroke, doing a width across, and I'm like, I have to dodge them and go around them. And it was, oh, but I suppose that was all part of the determination. Like, yeah, it was a rough old road, but like, I think sometimes that stands to you too, that nothing's handed to you too easily. So yeah,
I mean, I love the fact that you've got these songs sealed in a safe at your mum's house, because you obviously had great confidence that there was some worth in them. And I just wondered, what else have you hung on to that are kind of remnants of who you are and what you've gone on to become?
Well, actually, I did. My uncle Declan, who's the country singer, Declan Nerney, it was the songwriting. He did like my voice, but it was more the songwriting that he really saw something in. And he gave me that encouragement. He said, there's something really, really strong there with your songs. So I think that really did encourage me. And one of the songs that I wrote when I was 15 was called Raider Off My Sleep. And that actually went on then to win a national song contest so I wrote it like in 97, and it won in 2004. So several years later, and I won a lovely big trophy. And then I won it again 2 years later with another song that I wrote. So they're like,
did you twice?
Yeah, I won it 2004, the Glint Song Contest. It was a national song contest. It's not running anymore, but it ran for over 20 years. And so I was very lucky to win that. So things like that, little milestones like that keep you going and encourage you. And you sort of feel like you're doing something right. So that one song was one of my big achievements at the time. So
how old were you when you won those?
I was like 22, I think, when I won the first one, and then 24. So 22 and 24 I won. Wow. And then the following year I joined the Saturdays then after that.
Now, before we get to that massive move, which saw you leave your home and cross the ferry, go and do the ferry crossing to start your new life, you'd had a flirtation with what felt like trying to have a normal job or a more regular job. So you'd worked as a medical secretary. You took like a year out, didn't you? And you studied nursing and then primary teaching. So you tried lots of different things. And then what led to that moment of you going, do you know what? This just isn't me. I'm going to go and pursue music, when you were 23 years old.
Well, I sort of felt that I should find something to fall back on. And because I studied quite hard in school, I had like the points. You know, it was a point system over here to get into university. And I had enough to do the things that I felt I would probably happily fall back on if music didn't work out. So I attempted, I'm not proud to say it, and I wouldn't gloat about it, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. I think everyone should like find something that you enjoy and just get through it and qualify in it, because you don't have to. It's not like this is going to be you for the rest of your life. But I just couldn't settle into, I tried nursing, I tried primary school teaching. I took a year out first to do a secretarial course, and that's why I worked as a medical secretary. And I had a medical background because my dad's was a GP and my mum was a nurse. So I felt, you know, I'll be quite at home doing that. So I did work at that for a while, but it was always the music. And anyone that knew me knew that all I wanted to do was music. So I just was like, this is it now. I'm going to pack in the ambition of being a nurse or a teacher and just focus on the music. So I did that, and I bought my own PA system, and I had a Honda Civic car, which I let the seats down and made it like into a little van with all my equipment. It was probably not even strapped in properly. Gosh, God only knows what the situation was. But I toured around Ireland playing in pubs and clubs and hotels. And I eventually got some residencies where I'd be there like in one hotel every Friday night and another one every Saturday night. And I was sort of going along doing that really. And I knew that wasn't a career, but it was, for me, it was my apprenticeship of getting out and performing. Even though some nights it might only be in front of 10 people, you know, you could have a crowd in after a match and there could be 100 people or 200 people, and you just have to keep them entertained. So I had like a set list of songs for when it was a rowdy night and a set list of songs when it was a quiet one and they were listening. And I used to really enjoy on the nights where it was quiet that I get to drop in my own originals, and I'd say, this next one is one of my own. And then they'd really listen, and there were some real musos there really enjoying it. And I loved that. And then I used to have an EP of I had a producer I worked with, a local guy, and we did an EP of my original songs. So some of the ones from the safe made it onto that, and it was called Sorry, the EP, and I used to sell it for €5 at the end of a gig. So I did that for a few years.
You did. You covered a lot of ground. You really did put the hours in. You got your air miles as an up-and-coming singer-songwriter. You plugged your own PA system in. You drove yourself to the gigs. You sold your own EPs in the foyer afterwards. I love that. Do you consider that now to have been an invaluable apprenticeship?
Oh, definitely. I would say to anyone, you know, the most important thing is to get out there and perform. You know, don't perform. You can't just perform. Now, obviously, there's the internet. You can just get out to millions of people all in one go or whatever. We didn't have that back then. So, but it's nothing. There's nothing like live music and performing in front of real people. But that is just very important. You know, you can't just be dreaming in your bedroom. You have to get out and do it. And it isn't easy. And it's really tough. And you'll have days where you feel, oh, I'm going nowhere with this, you know, and there's an awful lot of kind of false hopes as well along the way. Like I did, was very lucky to be a backing vocalist for Brian Kennedy in the Eurovision in 2006. So that was a great experience.
Yeah. So for just in case for anybody listening outside of Ireland who might not have heard of Brian Kennedy, he's an Irish royalty, music royalty. There's like Brian Kennedy's huge, isn't he? He's loved. Beloved. I mean, there's only Bono that sits above him, really. Yeah,
his voice is incredible. Like, he's one of the best male vocalists I've ever worked with, you know, and I've been lucky to, like, since go and do some duets. I did a show, a TV show here in Ireland last year, and I got to sing with him one of his first songs. I think it might have been one of his first single even. And so I've got to work with him again, which is really nice, and kept in touch. But little things like that are like, you know, things that happen along the way that you feel, gosh, this is going somewhere. But then there's loads of carrots being dangled along the way too, of projects that people go, oh, we'd love for you for this new, I've heard this is going to be this next band and they're looking for this person and you'd be brilliant. And then you go and meet them and then it never happens. And there's an awful lot of that as well. So you have to just be prepared for, if you are wanting to pursue a career in music, you know, there's an awful lot of setbacks and knockbacks along the way, you know. You just have to be prepared for that too and not see it as a failure. It's just part of what it is, you know.
Have you kept anything from those sort of seminal moments? Have you still got your I don't know, anything from the Eurovision, anything from your days as a gigging muso that could sit alongside the unopened envelopes in the safe?
Oh, well, I've still got my EP. Sorry, I have a few of them knocking around. I used to sell them online as well on a site called CD Baby. And then that was when downloads started. I was delighted. Like, you'd actually see, you could log in and see who was buying your or downloading your music. And I could see, like, it was being like downloaded in, like, yeah, America and South America and Australia. I was get so excited. Any one person just bought it. I'm like, oh, this is so cool, you know? So I did that as well. And so I still have the old EP of that. What else do I have? I've loads of pictures, you know, so I've loads of nice memories with photographs and that of doing the gigs. And well, my parents actually used to help me. They were like my roadies. They used to come along, either my mother or my father, and they'd help me bring the gear in and they'd kind of sit at the back just because obviously some of the bars I'd sing in were very rough, you know, so especially after a match, you know, when they'd have a few drinks in. You know, it was just me, a young girl on my own up on the stage. So, but they were always very respectful, I have to say. But just in case, you know, we'd have my dad, the roadie, at the back. Watching on. So GP by day, roadie by night, you know. Oh, everyone used to laugh at that, actually. And he's the most unroadie person you'd ever meet in your life, you know. He's really, yeah, you couldn't tell. He was very camouflaged, which was good. But yeah, and it was lovely as well, because he was probably more than my mother. She was very, very encouraging and supportive of the music, whereas he was a little bit more, you need to find something that you want to do, you know, you need to go to university. And he kind of like got a bit angry one night. I remember having a fallout with him about it, and I was like, I want to do music. And and then he ended up being the roadie. So it's like, you know, and I'm sure he's pleased enough now.
Yeah, but you know, you're incredibly self-starting and tenacious, and having to have spent so long lugging your own gear around and being self-starting to get yourself up and running. How did it work then that you then joined the Saturdays and then you have to fall in as part of a group unit rather than just being, you know, a solo artist?
Well, I used to gig with groups as well as being on my own. Like I was in a group in town called Unreal. That was the first band I was in when I was only 17 with guys. I was the lead singer. We'd play like all, you know, I used to sing. I didn't actually play guitar in that. There was a guitarist, a bass player and a drummer. So I worked in a group environment with them. And then I used to do some corporate work when I was gigging around as well, where I'd work with other people as well. And I enjoyed that because it's not as lonely. It's nice having the company as well, you know. So when I saw there was an audition, I actually had auditioned for quite a few things while I was, you know, within those few years of gigging around, and just wasn't quite my time, and I don't think I was ready, but like I didn't get through the auditions, like I'd get maybe one or two, a couple of rounds, and didn't quite make it in. So I guess my time came at that. I felt very, very prepared and very ready to go for something. And I Googled the audition. I was at home here in Ireland, and I was like thinking, what should I do now? Where am I going with this? And I just don't know why. I just sat down and typed in audition. I was like, I'm going to start in London and see what happens over there. And I kind of had notions of heading off to New York and all sorts. You know, it was like kind of, at the time I was young, free and single. I could do what I want. So I was like, kind of like see what's out there. So I just Googled auditions in London for singers, and I just came across this advert for looking for female vocalists aged between 18 and 28, which is quite a gap, you know. And I was like, that's lovely, because I'm not being ageist there, because I was 25 at the time. So I was like, that's nice. Okay, yeah, I could do that. And it was like, they did say looking for a female vocalist aged between 18 and 28 that can dance. I was like, oh, and I can, you know, I've got rhythm and I can dance, but I hadn't been trained and I've never really taken lessons or anything like that. So that was something that I was like, oh gosh, I don't know now, because I knew I couldn't be like a pussycat doll, you know, for instance. But luckily the group, we weren't doing those kind of routines. It was a lot more about the performance, and there were quite cute routines that weren't too difficult. So I really enjoyed them, and it was like a whole new experience for me as well, stepping away from sitting on a bar stool with a guitar, you know. So I did audition and just flew over, and it was a series of rounds of auditions actually. So I was over and back between Ireland, still doing my pub gigs, and then flying over to London to do the audition. I kept it really, really quiet, because that's something I learned along the way as well. You have to keep things until they actually happen, especially in the entertainment industry. Until it actually, I see it happening and I'm doing it, I don't tell people anymore, because I was like all excited about stuff and be telling everyone the whole time. I'd be like, did you hear Una's getting into the new Louis Walsh band? And then it wouldn't happen, you know. So
did you ever audition for Louis?
He used to call me, so he'd know my uncle Declan Ernie, the country singer, from, because Louis used to actually manage show bands back in the day, and my uncle would have been in those bands, and he was very familiar with my uncle. Every time he saw me, he would call me, oh, it's Declan Ernie, he'd say, you know. That's what he used to call me. So like I knew him well before even, I was in the band. And they were putting together an Irish Pop Stars. That's the one that I got down to the last few in that, but I didn't quite make it in. So he was the judge on that. And then I met him before that as well. There was another band that never went anywhere. It was a mixed band that I was in, another pop group. I feel like I've had a few lifetimes here. The way I'm talking, it's kind of looking back on it. What was I? Forget half the stuff that I did.
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I think we move quickly through life, certainly in our industry. And sometimes, you know, I find it when somebody interviews me, you sit down and they start running through all these things you do, and then you go, oh, and then I did this and then that. And suddenly you just realise, yeah, that's quite a lot. You've done a lot, Una.
Yeah, I was in another band called Deep, and there was like me, another girl, and two guys. It was around the time when the mixed a pop band was in fashion, when I think do you remember the original Pop Stars was a mixed group, wasn't it? So that didn't take off.
Hearsay.
Yeah, Hearsay, yeah. So we had our version of Hearsay, and it was basically you never heard of Say. Never to be heard of. That's what we should have called ourselves.
So I'm just trying to think, like, back in the day, the time that you're talking about, I would have been somebody that was in contact with Louis Walsh. Boyzone were a thing. Then came Westlife. Louis could talk anyone into a record deal.
Oh, if his name was just like, if you were associated with him at all, it meant you were going to be a huge star, you know. Because he's very good to spot talent, I have to say. He really does. And he does know his stuff. But he, like, yeah, I think he always, me and him, we always had a bit of a soft spot for each other. So I think, like, you know, I think he was quite delighted to see that, you know, because he would have known that I had quite a few knockbacks along the way. So I think he was happy for me when he saw that I got into the Saturdays then after all that.
So took me through that audition, because were you auditioning for Peter Lorraine?
Yeah, it was. So it was a major on the audition as well, which I knew it was like a big deal, because it said major label looking for female vocalist. So I was like, that's cool. So it's for a label, it's not just some chancers, because there's an awful lot of them out there. So you'll see hundreds of auditions advertised. I was just lucky I went for the right one at the right time, and it was in the right, I was ready for it, you know. So
Peter, let me just, if I just explain to everyone, Peter was working for a major record label. Prior to that, I'd got to know him because he was the editor of Top of the Pops magazine, while I was the editor of Smash Hits. And Peter famously, I mean, he's so brilliant at everything he does. He's a fine editor, an incredible music manager.
But he came up with all of the nicknames for the Spice Girls.
I know.
So he came up with Baby, Sporty, Scary. He christened them. And then he went over to work for a label and put together on his own kind of imprint, his own label, The Saturdays, having already successfully managed Girls Aloud. So you knew when you walked into that room that, you know, there's some serious pedigree here. This could be a serious opportunity.
Yeah, so it was Polydor Records and Universal. Polydor, Peter was there because Peter was working for, he was the head of marketing of Polydor, and then he then had his sub-label off that Fascination, which we were assigned to as well. And now Peter's my manager at Fascination Management. So we've been together a long time, right from the beginning of the Saturdays to this day. So it's lovely. Yeah. So, and there was also like, they had like, yeah, the record label there, the marketing, the A&R as well. Actually, the first audition I went to was just the A&R there. So it was a few like, yeah. And then the major one, there was the final one was in Soho, and it was in a venue where we went downstairs. And I just remember looking around, hundreds of girls there thinking, I'm never going to get through this. But I think because I didn't put the pressure on myself, I was like, do you know what, if I don't get this, I'm gonna keep going, and I'll probably go off to New York anyway. That's what I said in my head. And I remember being there, yeah, in the queue, and I remember Rochelle was in front of me because it was all alphabetical as well. So I think they alphabetically put it with your first name, because I was thinking, how could I, because Rochelle, her maiden name was Wiseman, and so she, yeah, so we must have been RQRSTU. So I think that's why we were next to each other. And we really hit it off, and we made really good friends that day, actually, because she was in the queue next to me. We'd go in the rounds together and stuff. And I remember seeing Molly, actually, in the previous audition that I was in as well. And that was in a venue, just a bar called The Spice of Life. You know, it's there in London Central, so somewhere around. I think it's near Covent Garden, around there. I thought she looked so like Sienna Miller. I remember she had really long blonde hair at the time. And I actually thought it was Sienna Miller. And I was looking across her going, why is Sienna Miller here? You know, must be quite a good band if she's auditioning, you know. And then, yeah, I really got really good friends with Rochelle, and we kept in touch. And then luckily we both got into the group in the end as well. And I even remember before we were actually selected as the final five, I think we were down to the last 10. I actually stayed with Rochelle, and she came and picked me up at the airport, and I stayed at her house. She was still living at home at the time. She was only young, she was only 18, you know. So, but yeah, so we made friends even before we got in the group. So that was really nice. So that when we were all put together, like I felt like I'd already made friendships with a couple of the girls before that, even through the audition process, which was nice.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Now, all of this takes me so nicely to my next question for you, because it's glorious to hear that there was so much striving on your part to get to where you were determined to be, which was, you know, top of the charts with a great band and the opening the doors to the industry that you've pursued for so long. If you look back on yourself now, as you move through life and you evolve and you grow, what bits of the old you do you think that you've shed along the way that you miss, and which bits are you glad you'll never see again?
Oh, I still think I'm very true to myself. I don't think I've changed an awful lot. Even just moving back here and living at home, and I've got some of my school friends that I grew up with and I've known since I was only 7. I've always stayed very grounded about everything, and I wouldn't really want to be a new version of myself, if an older, wiser one. But I wouldn't change a thing. I think everything happens for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. And I love the strife, and I love the climb, and that it makes the rewards so much better when you work hard for them and you appreciate them and everything that goes along with it. Like I appreciate it every moment and feel so lucky to have got into that group, because I know the amount of hundreds and thousands and millions of girls that would have loved that opportunity. So I appreciated that so much, and I'm glad that it didn't come easy to me. So I wouldn't change anything. And even things like, say, in personal things that have happened in my life, I don't like to look back and go, I wish that didn't happen, because there's always, everything does happen for a reason. Like, I wouldn't have my kids if it wasn't for my marriage to my ex. So that's the thing. You have to just take the rough with the smooth, because nothing is plain sailing in life. You have to be prepared for it all, in everything, not just music industry, just life in general. You have to just get on with it.
Did you not find that once you had kids, for me, I found I sort of lost a bit of my own identity for a while. I just became Ben's mum, which I was really happy to be. But then I started to miss elements of me. Like, I missed work me. I missed fun me that wasn't always tired. And I was really keen to reclaim those facets of my old personality. So I started to stick those bits back on again. And I sort of missed my bravery from when I was younger. And when you're applying for anything and you're talking about, you're at this audition, you think, if not, I'll just go to New York. Like, I wish I could have that simplistic bravery now, because you can't. You've got kids. You're like, well, I couldn't go to New York. I mean, I'd have to find a school and, blah, 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 blah. And you just taught yourself out of stuff because reality bites.
Yeah, the responsibility is much greater now. And, but I actually, throughout the group, I had both Aoife and Tadhg while I was in the Saturdays. And I look back and there's loads of pictures of me with a big pregnant belly on stage doing the tours. So I kind of they sort of were born into the group as well. And I remember when I did The Voice of Ireland, I did that for 2 years. I was pregnant during the battles section of that. And then I had Tadhg and I was back doing the live shows. He was only 6 weeks old, but I was back after Aoife, only after 5 weeks, I was back on stage with the girls. I think a lot of people would probably look at that and say that's way too soon. And he probably was, but that's just how it was at the time. And as they say, you have to make hay while the sun shines. And I was very, very, very lucky. My mum was very hands on and always has been and still is to this day. Like, I don't know how I would do it without her. So she came even out to LA when we shot the reality show with the E! Channel, the Chasing the Saturdays. Aoife was only, she's only 6 months old, and she came out there. So she was flying across to LA with me. So I just took her with me. I sort of, rather than adapting my life to her, she slotted in. And that's just how it always has been. But not without that help that I have and support with my family, with my mum in particular. I don't think I would have been able to do it without her.
So you didn't really have an opportunity to lose your identity with the kids, because you were still being Una from the Saturdays, as well as a new mum.
I threw myself straight back into it. And I know that a lot of people wouldn't agree with that, but that it was just, I made a conscious decision to do that at the time. And I don't regret it either, I've had plenty of time to make up for it in the, bonding with the kids scenario, with everything with lockdown. I think that's kind of why I don't want to complain about it, because in that first lockdown as well, when it was just me and the two kids and it was very lonely, and that at the same time, we really did cement as a unit, the three of us, that's the family, the mum and the two kids. And it was like, that was a very important time, I think, for me as a person and as a mother and everything. That's obviously this whole situation is awful, because people are obviously dying and it's really sad and people are losing their loved ones, and it's very hard to look at it in any positive way, because it's not, but the situation that we're all doing to have to keep safe and try and protect each other is that, to stay at home. And with that staying at home, I did find it was a really good time to really bond, and because they say that they grow up so quickly, which they do. I've noticed that more and more, nearly every day I feel like they look older. I can actually see them growing older every day. That happens with children, I feel.
That probably was a very important healing time for you then, wasn't it? To be locked down with the kids at a time when you had to re-establish what your family unit was. So whilst it's hard, you only come out of it stronger.
Definitely, yeah. Because I remember the first time I went away with Aoife when I just first separated. I went on holiday with her because Tig stayed at home and it was just me and I was like, let's have a little girly holiday. Went out and joined my friends in their parents' villa out in Portugal. So there was two couples there with, and they were all there as couples with their kids. And it was just me as a single mum with my daughter. And I did feel, I remember walking through the airport and looking around and seeing all the family, like I felt like everyone was a family and without, and I was the only single person, like, which is not true. There's so many other people in the same position, but you, it's like when you buy a car, every car you see is the same one. Or if you're pregnant, everywhere you look, everyone's pregnant. It's that kind of thing, isn't it? Because you're so conscious of it.
Yeah.
But I was really conscious of the family units that were around, and that word as well, family unit. I was just like, I used to get really upset about thinking I don't have that anymore. And look at me on my own and look at, you know, there'd be a man walking by with his daughter and then he'd go tell mummy, go tell mummy to get this. No, daddy can't do that right now. And you're like, ugh! You know, like not in a begrudging way, because like obviously that's fair enough, you know. I was probably like them a couple of years before that, but just kind of heart-wrenching a bit at the same time. I was like, oh, that's not me now anymore. And it took a while to get used to the fact that, you know, that mummy is enough, you know. And then, yeah, that time during lockdown of just me and the kids, like they have all the love they need and they had each other. And we were just like, it was lovely, actually, to create that bond and to lose that feeling. You know, I don't feel like that at all anymore. I've none of I don't crave that family unit of having to be husband and wife, kids, you know.
It's like an echo chamber coming back at me. It's lovely to hear. It's affirming my own experience as well. I remember when I first became a single mum, I used to hate going to the park and seeing, especially on the weekends. I was fine going in the week, but at the weekends when I saw dads with their kids and my son didn't have that, it just killed me.
Yeah, I was like that in the swimming pool. On a Sunday, I'd go swimming with the two kids and I just felt like all I could see was dads bouncing around with their children and being such great dads. And I was like going, oh, there's mine just going, I'm like shouting after them or saying, put on your armbands. But like, it's only me that noticed that. No one else would have noticed. And it just was so conscious of it, really. And actually, to be honest, wasn't really enjoying it. I was like, I don't want to be here like this on my own. But now I'm like, I'd be happily there on my own. I wouldn't even notice it. The dads would be there and I'd just be seeing through them. I don't think about it anymore. But it just takes time. It takes a long time, actually. Well, it takes a year or two anyway for me to get used to that. It's so lovely to know as well that you're not alone, that there's so many others in the same boat. And you're so much better off, because you're much better off to be without the wrong person than stuck in a relationship that you're not happy in or that's not working out. You know, it's that's just the way it is. And it just happens, you know.
I always want to reach out to anybody that's at the beginning of that experience, because I know how painful it is. And it really is. And it should be, because, you know, your children are created with love and, you know, with a vision that you're going to spend the rest of your lives together as a family. So it should hurt when it doesn't work out, but you just want to save the women that are, and the men that are going through that, and just go, it's all right. It feels really shit now, but it's going to get easier. It gets better. You'll smile again. You won't think about it so much. You know, it's all going to be okay.
You have to feel, it's a good sign if you're hurting, because you have to go through that hurt, literally go through the hell to get out the other side. There's no way around it. There's no way to jump across it or go, get around the edges. You have to go through it. And you will, and it will hurt, but you will, it does, you feel so much better. I don't look back now, and also I don't hold that resentment like I did for a while. I felt, you know, a little bit bitter, to be honest, you know, and just, you know, a bit of a chip on the shoulder and all that kind of thing. And now I'm like, I find just such relief in not feeling that anymore. And I don't have any hate. I don't have that. I just don't feel hate or hatred or resentment or anything now. Just, I'm happy to move on, and I'm in a really good place now. Really good.
Could not agree more. Well, it's nice to see that you're able to swim without your armbands.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Yeah. This is not like, easy.
No, it's not. And even like as a child, I went back in again. When I started drowning without the armbands, I still went back in and was so determined. I think because of the setback and almost drowning, I was like, I'm going to be the best swim, fastest swimmer in Ireland. And I did say that to my mother. I was like, I think an 8 year old, 7 or 8 year old, I want to be she said she remembers me getting dressed in the changing room afterwards going, Mammy, I'm going to be the fastest swimmer in Ireland. And I think if you just believe that and...
And then you were.
Yeah. I was just so determined. Oh, and you should be also, that for anyone as well going through the grief, just be so determined to know, believe in yourself that you will, then you are strong enough, but you have to just accept that the armbands are on. Don't go like running away with it, like taking them off and trying to swim. Don't put that pressure on yourself. You don't have to, you know.
Imagine a night out. Imagine right now you could go anywhere with anyone, do anything. If there was one night from your life, and it could be a gig, it could be dancing with girlfriends, it could be a date, whatever you want it to be, Una, if you could go back and live one prolific night again, tell me about that night.
Well, that's asking now, what was the best night of my life? Best nights are like when you catch up with old friends. I love that. That kind of reminiscing. I'm big into like nostalgia and that sort of thing. So I just love sitting in with old friends and catching up and chatting about the old days. You know, those kind of nights are really like, they're the kind of nights in that I enjoy. And just you're laughing. Laughter is the best medicine, I have to say, for everything. And I have a couple of friends that are really, really funny. And I find just being around people that make you laugh, it doesn't really matter where you are or what you're doing or what you're drinking or what you're not or who what you're wearing or anything like that. It doesn't matter. And to be honest, nights where there's no, like I look back probably the nights pre-phones, pre-Instagram, pre-all that, when I was like just a teenager, like the nights out, those nights were the best. And they're the ones I'd like reminisce on now and like laugh about. So I enjoy the nights of looking back on them, but looking back on the nights when everything was so exciting because you're experiencing things for the first time. So like as a late teen, early 20s, those kind of nights out were the most fun because everything's like sort of so fresh and new. And then those kind of like first loves that you think you literally start like planning your wedding day with anyone you literally just met at a disco or whatever, you know, and then being heartbroken about them. And oh, just those times. Like I would say my favorite decade was the 90s. I love the 90s and I still listen to 90s music, like, and it gets me all nostalgic again.
Yeah. What about when you stepped out onto some of the best stages you ever have? You know, Good Evening Wembley. Oh, I mean, is that a night you'll never forget?
They're like when you party on stage. They're, oh, the memories I have of being on stage performing, and especially when I'd come back now to Ireland and singing to the home crowd and they throw up an Irish flag and you'd just be so proud. And yeah, like that, you look down the audience and you can actually pick out some of your family. I have a big family because my dad was one of 15. So I've actually got 60 plus first cousins. So, you know, half the audience were them, or, you know, I'd actually see them. Oh, there's cousin Mary. There she is. And, you know,
Jesus. And so your family get togethers, I would imagine that, you know, like if you're playing a gig in Dublin, certainly in your days with the Saturdays, Your family guest list must be exhausting.
Oh, yeah, it was tough. You know, I'd always remember the tour manager, Mark, would always be like, he'd always remind me in plenty of time, make sure you get me in that set, that guest list, because I know there's going to be a long one. And I keep adding to it. And it was like going out the door. And then we have meet and greets and they'd all turn up. And I'm going to be seeing you afterwards anyway. Why are you here? You know, and you know me, you're coming for me. And I guess they obviously wanted to meet the girls as well and have their picture. They were kind of, Una, get out of the way. Oh, can I get in beside Molly and Michelle and Frankie and Vanessa? Yeah.
And there you go. Less expensive than a wedding, less sad than a funeral. It's a winning occasion to gather the troops.
Yeah, exactly. We need to get back now again to do that in the future. But sure, God knows when there'll be another gig. This is the thing. It's tough to know.
Soon.
Nobody can tell.
Please, when God.
Live music again.
But you have new music out. You've been recording. You are releasing. You are all over our radios with Country Hits Radio. So where can people find the music and how can they support you and other musicians during this testing time?
Yeah, so I'm releasing a new single called Swear It All Again. It's my new single. I actually wrote the song. I think I wrote it a few years ago, actually, like maybe 3 years ago, I'd say that I wrote it. So it's not like it's not a present. So it's not about anything that's happening currently in my life. And the song is actually about a relationship that, even though, you know, it's not working out, you know, one of those ones that you just, you know, it's not deep down, but you'll do anything to save it because you feel it's worth saving at the time. So that's what the song is about. It's about the struggle of keeping a relationship that's failing together. That's what the song is about.
It's been so lovely chatting to you and learning so much more about a life that's been extraordinarily well lived and, You've worked so hard. Continued success to you.
Thanks, Kate.
I hope that you really do set up the perfect home for yourself and your kids and your new unit in Ireland. And bloody good luck to you, my friend.
Oh, thanks so much. And you know that you say that as well. I kind of feel like I am home. And as you said, the perfect unit for me is me as a single mother and my two kids. And I kind of like just had a little vision there of like a shamrock, you know, that's the unit, the three-leaf shamrock.
There you go.
Yeah. So that's because I know I've no tattoo and I'm always thinking of what could I get a tattoo of? And I know it's a bit cheesy, but I think a shamrock would be a nice one.
I think you can. I think you could style that out beautifully. Good luck with everything, Una. I know that we will be hearing lots more from you because you don't do as much as you've done and then just suddenly disappear, and that's a great thing.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's it for this week's show. If you have the time and the inclination, please do rate and review us. It really does help other people to find and discover the show. As always, White Wine Question Time is produced by me, Kate Thornton, with Richard Hatherall for Yahoo UK. Editing and co-producing is by Callum Goddard-Mucklow, and our music, as always, is provided by Andy Bell. His back catalogue with Oasis, Ride, and his solo material are available on Spotify and iTunes. Please do, as we always do when we make this podcast, and drink responsibly. I'll see you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.